What's up, guys? This podcast was recorded while I was overseas in Hong Kong. A lot of you probably did not know this, but my dad is a journalist based in Hong Kong. And so my brother and me, my brother Day Nine, we went on a family trip where we stayed over there. It was really cool. It was kind of crazy, actually, because it was in the middle of the protests. So that was wild to see. I've been going to Hong Kong since I was a kid. My dad's worked there off and on, and so it was kind of cool to be back there and have the family together again. So this is a two-part episode. This was actually the first time I had to set up the equipment because Melty couldn't be there with me, which was actually pretty intimidating. But we did record this in the Airbnb that I was staying in. It's going to be a two-part episode again. And the first part, we talk a lot about games and our childhood. And part two, you'll see. We have a lot of cool stuff that we discussed here. I'm really glad I had the opportunity to sit down and do this. And now that I've kind of gotten the hang of setting up this equipment on my own, whenever I travel to an event overseas, or I guess anywhere for personal reasons, I can always do a podcast there, which is really cool.
Yeah, I know. I mean, you did such a good job of setting up the equipment all on your own while you were in Hong Kong. I feel like you...
I was scared, man.
Yeah. I mean, it only took like four phone calls.
It was pretty intimidating, actually, setting all this stuff up.
Yeah.
Melty.
Tasteless.
It's time to plug the Patreon. If you guys are enjoying this podcast, I want you to know these microphones were not cheap. we have the highest quality stuff here for the podcast, but it is supported by viewers or listeners like you. If you have some spare change and you can throw it our way, it's really appreciated. What is the next thing we're going to buy with the Patreon money, Melty?
We're actually going to buy a video camera and some lights.
That's right.
Yeah.
We're eventually going to have a visual format for this.
Yeah.
And you can see how dull my living room is. But people keep asking for a camera, so as the Patreon money comes in, we're going to get that camera set up. Tripod too, I guess, and then... Lights are probably pretty cheap, right?
I think so. I think we can get some pretty good lights. I know a couple people who...
You know some people?
Yeah, I know some people.
I wasn't expecting you to say that. Like, you got the lights hookups. Also, if you guys can support us, please do that on Patreon. It's patreon.com/tastelesspodcast. What is something else we would get with Patreon money, Melty?
Well, our current plans for the Patreon money is we're going to get a video camera, lights, tripod, all that. We're going to eventually get more microphones. We can have more than just Tasteless and one person. We may be able to get like three or four people on.
Yeah, that's going to be really cool if we can eventually get there. And I think we will as time passes. So again, guys, if you can support us on Patreon, it is really appreciated. And now to part one of the Tasteless podcast with his little brother, Day Nine. Enjoy.
Okay, we're here. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Nick. Hey, I'm on your podcast, man.
This is cool. We are in Hong Kong right now. It's not our first time being down here. It is raining like crazy outside.
Very abruptly, too. Like, out of nowhere.
Yeah, we actually had to, like, we didn't have umbrellas. We were at a cafe earlier, so we had to hop from, like, corner store to corner store under the canopies to even get back down here. But we're here now. Now, this is not our first time together in Hong Kong. We were here, like... 15 years ago?
It must have been in 2002 between my summer, or my sophomore and junior year.
Yeah, and so our dad was based out in Hong Kong. He's a journalist. He's traveled around a lot since then, but now he's back here for work. So we both popped through for a family trip. And I guess when we were traveling back then, traveling was sort of a different thing, right? Like, I didn't really appreciate seeing the world, I think, like I do now, you know?
Let's be honest. Okay, I'm 32.
Yeah.
When I think about 27-year-old Sean, I'm like, what a fucking moron. it is so hard to grow older and just to re-remember the things you thought as a child. Because, I mean, when we got here, we immediately, this is in 2002, we're both in high school, we get here and we go, Dad, can we install StarCraft on your computer?
That's right.
Is there an arcade? Like, we literally just tried to figure out how to do exactly what we did with life anyways.
Yeah,
but in Hong Kong.
It's funny because that's when we first showed him StarCraft.
Yeah.
Little did we know it would be the vehicle that got us to travel the world and, you know, make a living.
Yeah. I downloaded StarCraft II in the hotel on my new laptop when I got here. Yeah. Like, watching replays and stuff. It's like, yep, nope, doesn't change.
And then after this, we're going to go back to an arcade. The arcade we used to go to, it was in Times Square in Hong Kong. We used to take because we were in Hong Kong for about 2 weeks when we first came here.
Yeah.
And so we would go take this. I think we took a taxi there every time, right?
Oh, absolutely.
I think Dad wasn't sure about us taking the train at that point in time.
No, I mean, again,
kids from Kansas, we would not know how to necessarily just pick up on using the subway.
I mean, he didn't even trust us with the tram yesterday.
Come on, go. So, when we would go to these arcades, and this is kind of one of the first things I just wanted to talk about with you, is because we grew up going to arcades, whether it was in Kansas or in Hong Kong. And one of the things that blew me away when I came to the Hong Kong arcades with you, and this is basically what we would do in the middle of the day, and then we'd meet up with Dad at night because he was working.
Yeah.
But just the sheer size and the number of people there.
It was ridiculous. You know, and it was packed, too. And they also kind of had the essence of they get how to do this properly. You know, they had like a little cafe set up. There were different sections that were cordoned off by genres. You know, like in Kansas City, you'd have the mishmash of like Virtua Tennis right by Marvel vs. Capcom 2, right next to a claw machine. Right then, God, I can't even believe how big it must have been, like a 10,000 square foot arcade. It was absolutely insanely gigantic. And it was also packed crowded because, you know, Fun Factory was the name of the arcade we went to as a kid at good old Oak Park Mall at 95th and Quivira.
Yeah, we went to that was the arcade we went to as kids. So, do you go to arcades anymore? I know you're based in the Bay Area.
I mean, I go really weirdly. I like to just go there and just kind of stand and think about what it's like to be at an arcade. I'm not a regular at all. Like, there's not really terribly many good arcades where I'm at in Oakland.
Yeah, it seems like especially in North America, a lot of the arcades, at least the way they were presented initially, have gone away. Now there's, I guess you call them a barcade. That was always something that surprised me.
When
I came back to the States and I realized, oh, all the old arcade games I used to play are now in bars.
So we actually have to clarify something. For any of you who have never been to arcades, there's actually different kinds of arcade players. Nick is crazy good at fighting games, and he does the same cheesy bullshit in fighting games that he does with Protoss in StarCraft, right? Like,
yeah.
He's like, how do you cannon rush in this game? Oh, you pick Blanca? All right, cool. Right?
That's right. You pick Team Scrub in Marvel.
Yeah, and I mean, like, I'm pretty much appalling at fighting games, but I used to love to go and watch you guys play Marvel's Capcom, and I dabble a little bit in Soul Calibur. Hold on a second.
That's not totally true. You were very good at Soul Calibur 2.
Soul Calibur 1. Just the original Soul Calibur.
That's right. Yeah. I was thinking, yeah, the original one was Soul Edge before that.
Yes.
And then you were good at Soul Calibur. That's right. Okay.
Yeah, no, because I discovered that you could use the kick button, you know, because there was a horizontal and a vertical slash, and those looked cool. So his kids was like, oh, you know, he has a huge axe and he's swinging around. I discovered the kick button and quickly became the best player in Kansas City. But you know, like, so Nick, you're the sort of fighting game arcade player, but I'm the rhythm game arcade player.
Yeah.
Right? I really love my Beatmania 2DX and stuff like that. And in North America, it's so different than out here in the, you know, Southeast Asia, where there's actually like the rhythm game section and then rows of different fighting games in the fighting game section. I mean, you go to just a bar that has a whole bunch of ticket redemption games and you hope that somehow they have a Beatmania 2DX machine, or occasionally there'll be a small crowd by like a Street Fighter 4 machine and that's it.
It does seem like in North America, they didn't, and this might be just kind of a cultural thing, like, you know, when you're in Asia. So we're in Hong Kong, one of the most densely populated places ever. You know, people want to get out of their house. And everything is kind of, in a way, communal, right? I mean, you live in the city, but you're sharing a lot of stuff. This is especially true in Korea, where, especially in Western culture, especially in the United States, like the idea, for instance, I go to a Korean sauna, right? When I'm in Seoul. That's shared around with everybody from the community. But if I'm super rich and I'm doing well in the States, I want my own hot tub, my own sauna in my house.
Yeah.
You know? You'll even see people with their own pinball machines, you know, in the basement or the garage.
Oh, yeah.
That's kind of the sort of the American dream of collecting everything. But then that sort of kills, I think, the necessary communal element of what an arcade and a competitive arcade environment actually is.
Yeah, I mean, there's just a lot of space, you know, and I feel like America's catching up. I feel like America's catching up a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, especially our generation where most people have like ballooning college debt and they're just like, why would I get a house? Why would I get a car? Why would I even own the music that I want to listen to? Why don't I just get Spotify, things like that? And, you know, these types of communal places are starting to get much more interesting. I mean, certainly for me, I just always want to find cool spots to hang out at.
Yeah, that's a good point. It is definitely generational. Like millennials are absolutely more inclined to move into cities and use more, you know, sharing services and stuff like that. How did this happen? Was it that you ended up being more inclined to be the rhythm game player and I ended up being more inclined to be the fighting game player? Now, that being said, it's not like you couldn't play fighting games. I thought you were actually pretty good. And I could play games like Beat Mania, or we used to play Pump It Up, which is basically like the sister game to DDR. If you know DDR, then you know what Pump It Up is basically. How do you think that happened?
I mean, I think that you and I actually play games a little differently. Well, especially back then, I was much more obsessive about an extremely small amount of games. Like, obviously, StarCraft was one, but, I mean, even you played all the three races in StarCraft. I would only play Zerg and just do the same builds again and again and again and again and again, right, to try to work. And I would even do the restrictive thing where I would only play one matchup against one strategy while I did one strategy. I just have this obsessional aspect. And for whatever reason, I just got interested in Beat Mania, and that just became like the second game that I became absolutely obsessional about. And that was really different from you, that you play like fighting games, you play Beat Mania, you play StarCraft. I think you even played more Counter-Strike than I did back in high school.
No, I think you played more Counter-Strike than I did.
No, you played more Counter-Strike.
No, because
don't
I know,
put this on me, Nick.
I think you did, because you scrimmed. I think you scrimmed more with people.
That's right. Yeah, no,
I was sort of allergic to team games because I just got fed up with communicating. I liked doing StarCraft 1 2v2 a little bit, but now let me think about that. Yeah, it's, I guess that's true. I guess I actually did play more of the races. I actually got sad when I realized I really had to pick one race.
Oh, in StarCraft. I remember talking to me about this, because I think it was in like, I mean, pretty old. Like, I was in 10th grade, you were in 11th grade.
Yeah.
And I remember you just coming to me like, hey, I think I'm a Terran player. And I'd be like, oh, okay. And the next would be like, I'm also a Zerg player. No, I'm a Protoss. I'm a Terran player. And it was like, it took a few days for you to finally just go, you know what? I'm going with Protoss. I'm just doing this.
You know what's interesting is I actually had decided I had to play one race because I realized I couldn't play TVT and flesh it out. It was too long and demanding, and the openers were too flexible. And I thought, okay, like I can... You know, the other mirror matchups, especially at the time, because, you know, StarCraft is pretty old, Zerg versus Zerg and PvP, or Protoss versus Protoss, were more manageable. But Terran versus Terran, which, I mean, statistically can go on for an hour. I just thought, okay, there's just so much to map out here.
Yeah.
And then I thought ZVT didn't really gel with me at the time. There was all the matchups were basically played incorrectly back then. But I guess that's to go back to what you were saying, I guess you were more obsessive about a few specific games. So,
yeah,
your game in the arcade was Beat Mania, which I think the majority of people listening to this would not know what that is. They would be familiar with Guitar Hero.
Yeah, DDR.
But basically this game was a game where you had a turntable on the side, and then you had 5 to 7 buttons depending on the model. And there were two controller setups, so you could also play where you're playing... You could have it where you're playing both at once.
The same thing as doubles in DDR, yeah.
Right, exactly. So same idea.
And I believe that actually Beat Mania was the original rhythm game. Because, I mean, it was so simple and spare the way the game worked. A bar would fall down, and when it hit the bottom, you press the button that corresponded to it. That's it. It wasn't this more complicated motion in Guitar Hero where you have to hold the button and strum at the time, or even just stepping in DDR is a little bit more of a... You know, a step away from the absolute basic, just hit the right buttons. And I loved it. Because, you know, there's this thing that, you know, I say half jokingly, half seriously, that StarCraft 1 is first a management game, second a strategy game. You just have to hit so many buttons in such a precise sequence, zipping around everywhere, that anyone who's played Brood War and gotten really in the zone knows this feeling where your hands just feel good. You get done with a game and it feels so good, and you can like feel every nerve and joint and bone and muscle in your hands. And that's why I started to love Beatmania, because I just went and I was like, oh, what's this game? And I played it and I just got that same feeling in the hands. And I was, oh my gosh. I was.
Yeah, there's that tactile pleasure that I think was always hidden in StarCraft 1.
Yeah.
And I think this is something that's sort of lost in a lot of more modern games. I think where you actually see it, let's take a fighting game. I know it's not the most recent one, but since it's one that I'm very familiar with, Street Fighter 4, it was the combo inputs.
Yeah, yeah.
When you really felt the combos connecting, you thought, okay, there it is. There's something that feels good about this. And I think there was always a always a little bit of a misunderstanding with StarCraft, where everybody was focused on what the strategies were that they wanted to do. But in a lot of ways, StarCraft 1 was like a rhythm game. You had able to output all these things before you ever got to get to the strategy component.
Yeah, and I mean, the rhythms would be really long, you know, instead of just like 2 beats every second, it was 1 beat every 13 seconds. And instead of hitting a kick drum, it would build a marine, you know, and you just kind of had this real sense of everything just fitting and organizing together that just felt so good. Because, like, okay, make no mistake about it, it's kind of stupid that you can only select 12 units at once. Like, that's, it's stupid. They're like, I can't really defend that, but God, does it feel good to go 1A click, 2A click, 3A click, 4A click. Because, it, you know, if we think about a game as an excuse to make me feel some kind of pleasure, right? There's an intellectual pleasure that has a long loop that's around strategy. You know, this like, huh, maybe if I built this at this time, I could hold off that 12 zealot rush that always used to beat me as a kid, right? And then you figure it out, and that's an intellectual pleasure that took maybe a few hours to actually get the trying. Ah, I did it. But when you go 1A click, you just did 3 things and you get a little pop of happiness, a little pop of pleasure. 2A click, 3A click, 4A click. You need to retreat. 1 click, 2 click, 3 click, 4 click. And just it's these little tiny moments of pleasure that feel exactly like when you get a combo off in a difficult segment.
Or even throwing a fireball
in a
fighting game.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, because the fireball, just it appearing. Well, actually, you know, screw fireballs. Let's talk about uppercuts, like the Z motion. Like, that is the absolute
Dragon
newbie
punch.
Slayer.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, the dragon punch. I mean, when just you arcing into the air in and of itself is just confirmation that you did something right. And I feel like this is something that's so important in games that happen accidentally, in a lot of the games when we were younger, that, like you say, I feel like is kind of getting a little lost, because it's so easy to automate stuff. Super trivially easy to cut all these things away, but it really does give you a kick when you get a fireball off. You see the fireball move. Screw the damage that it does. I did a good thing. I input my buttons correctly.
It does seem like there's a whole movement in gaming in general to try to get past mechanics. Like, the mechanics were somehow an interference with what the game was supposed to be, where I always thought they were sort of intertwined. You know, there's been a lot of complaining about from some pros, and I'm not super up to date with Street Fighter V, but I kind of try to follow it when I can.
Yeah.
About the way the inputs work. There's like a little bit more of a delay, and it's a little bit more about.
Was it like an 8-frame delay?
I think so. I'm not totally sure.
I don't know that much about fighting games. I just want to sound smart. Can I just say that? Can I just say I wanted to sound smart?
Corey Gaming.
No,
yes,
I was watching Corey Gaming's videos recently, and that number stuck out in my head.
Think, no, like, I think it's an 8-frame delay.
I'm going to earn brownie points with the fighting game community.
Yeah, I think they made it a little bit more about trying to make the right decisions.
Yeah.
And a little bit less about rewarding somebody who is just mechanically strong.
Yeah.
But I feel like this is a thing that tends to get lost in a lot of games, where you realize, okay, I know that, for instance, let's take RTS. I know it's about strategy. I know it's about economy management. But one of the things I always thought was beautiful, and I'm not saying StarCraft 2 doesn't have this, because StarCraft 2 is a much more sped up game in a way.
Oh, God, yeah.
In a lot of ways, it's actually just better for watching, for I think most people who are trying to get into RTS games. I think StarCraft 2 is the cleanest representation of what can make RTS interesting. But I also think at times it misses out on some of these mechanical components, where there is some joy in trying to control stuff. I mean, for instance, you know, you're talking about 12 units. you can only grab 12 at a time in StarCraft 1. In some ways, that allows a comeback mechanic. The more you have, the more you have to manage. Yeah, someone can get ahead, but then they're juggling more things at once, or they're having to do more proper combos or inputs or sequences if it was a rhythm game. And so you get the lead, but with that lead, then you have to juggle more tasks, which in some ways can allow a player who might be closer to your skill to maybe catch up.
And I feel like the thing that's really interesting about when you look at a lot of old games and a lot of, I mean, even some of the notable failed projects in games the last like 10, 15 years or so. I want to be really clear. I think that a lot of what we're talking about is not the right way versus the wrong way.
Yeah.
It's totally fine to have a game with no input complexity. That's totally fine. It's totally fine to also have a game with tons of input complexity. But I think that all the games that we played as kids, I mean, back then in game development, you just kind of like said, here's an idea for a game, and then you just made it. You didn't even test it. You didn't even try to rework the ideas in the same way they do with modern game development. And a lot of games that were made back then, it was just you came up with an idea as a developer, and you just made it, and it was launched. You know, you didn't go through the same rounds of feedback and iteration that you wind up having with a lot of modern games. And as a result, you wound up with these pleasures that I feel like were accidental. And it's just taken years and years and years and years and years to try to figure out how to describe what the source of the pleasure is. And if you can name that, you can try to start reproducing it. And the funny thing that I see is that there's actually nothing sort of physiologically bad, or there's nothing intellectually wrong about control groups and you can only select 12 at a time. There's this bullshit intuition that a human brain has that it goes, why can't I just select all the units?
Well, also, I think things are just becoming easier for people. Everything can be done on your phone.
Well, I do want to focus really hard on the idea of like what just intuitively feels right, because there's this great talk by Mark Rosewater, the head designer of Magic the Gathering, where he talks about like aesthetics matter. Like if I go 1, 2, 3, your brain just autofills in 4. A, B, C. Fills in D is the next one. When you're in a game, if things don't have a certain pattern match to them, don't have a sort of intuitive basis to it, your brain starts asking the question, why is that this way? And then what happens is players start focusing on what your game isn't instead of what your game is. And that's what I find really interesting about some of the really modern success stories. You know, take something like MOBAs, which in some ways are one of the weirdest bullshit nonsense games that have ever existed.
That is very true. It's some of the most bizarre stuff. Yeah. It's crazy that this was imagined up and then modded into a game.
Yeah. But there's enough things that do function at a really basic intuitive level of I cast the ability, the explosion happens. I hit the button for my item, the item property happens. And, you know, that feels much more like, I'm using all of my items. Oh, damn, I messed up because I forgot to use an item. That feels way better than, I didn't select these 12 units and box move them back. There's something that doesn't feel quite as intuitive to a lot of people about that.
Also, I think a lot of the mechanical components are sort of accidentally hidden inside the game. Let's take StarCraft 1, for instance. And I want to talk about StarCraft 2 in this more as well. But, you know, in StarCraft 1, there's definitely the shock that you have where you show somebody the game and they say, okay, I want to do a DT rush. And I had to, you know, I've taught a bunch of my friends when I was at university.
Yeah.
And I'd say, okay, stop. You missed a probe. We have to restart. We're going to practice this build against a computer. And, you know, this would sometimes take 2 hours of them repeating this process before we get to where the first DT comes out. Because if you miss a probe or you're late on a pylon, the rush is probably just not going to work.
Yeah.
So, excuse me. So, basically, you have to learn this other game that you might have not even been presented with before you can actually play the game that you wanted to get to, right? It's kind of like, you know, people want to learn how to box and they think it's all about knowing how to throw the right jab, and then they discover, no, you need to be able to do so much cardio that you have the energy to be able to actually stand in a ring and try to hit somebody for 5 minutes.
You know, I think the health comparison is a perfect one. You know, like, ooh, I'm really interested in playing basketball. Great. Run 10 miles, right? Like, No, but running isn't have all the interesting aspects of passing and formations, and I have a really cool layup I can do. It's like, great, run 10 miles, you know?
It's like when you see a soccer player who can bounce a ball off of his head over and over and over, but you don't think about the fact that this guy can run for 5 miles without stopping.
That's the most plot physical feat I've ever heard. It's like, he can run 5 miles without stopping. Like, most of the people listening can run for 5 miles.
But you don't think
of
the fact that he could touch his toes.
Wow.
Yeah. No, that is very true. But the thing is, though, like, a lot of times what people see, whether it's a sport or an e-sport or any kind of game that involves a challenge, is the hidden parts that are actually embedded in there.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you look at – okay, so let's steer this in a different direction for a second, because we see this in other games as well. It used to be in older games, because they were modeled off of arcade machines, all right, you have 3 lives, right? And then you have maybe 4 continues. And a continue is essentially the coin that you put back into the machine to then get your 3 lives back. And so we can use – let's take Mario 1, the original Mario. Or you could use Mario 3. Maybe that's more well-known. But a lot of people in modern gaming might say, okay, the problem here is that they have to go all the way back to the beginning, where in a modern game, you die, will spawn you right back at the most recent point, so you can resume. And this is especially common in story-based games, like I'll take Uncharted, for instance. They want you to experience the game in the story where...
Oh, yeah.
In a lot of ways, what the Mario games were was forcing you, besides getting mechanically good at making Mario jump and move through the stage, was actually making you memorize the levels. And so you're sort of starting at point one. You're given a few chances to fail and a few opportunities to pick up an extra life.
Yeah.
But when you die, you go back to the beginning. Now, I know there's those tubes you can go through that let you warp to levels, but basically...
Those don't count in this discussion. Those
are for scumbags, but... Honestly, it was a different thing, right? It looked like the game was supposed to be learning how to make Mario jump over cliffs, but the hidden component was we're making you memorize the architecture and the features of each level until you've mastered them, and it's going to get increasingly hard. So as you're memorizing this and learning techniques, you're also getting trained for this final level where we're going to throw everything at you as Bowser, as you're trying to get to Bowser to beat the game.
And, you know, one thing I find that's really interesting about the Mario example is that, you know, I feel like single-player games have a pretty good grasp on how to structure themselves to satisfy whatever experience they're trying to, I should say, whatever emotional experience they're trying to evoke. You know, Uncharted is an experiential game. Uncharted would be a worse game if it had permadeath after, like, you know... After four deaths, you're gone.
If you had to go through every cutscene again and listen to all the dialogue, it would be annoying.
Yeah, Mario would be a worse game if when you fell into a pit, it spawned you to the left of the pit. Give it another shot, Booster.
Like,
it would be a worse game. And I think what's so fascinating about multiplayer games, especially like very competitive games, in multiplayer games, it's so much harder to match the person's emotional expectations with what their emotional experience actually winds up being, because there's this interesting marriage of sort of two things going on with any game, and this is just a simplification for sure, but like there is the narrative elements, which would be like, you know, in StarCraft you get to be the commander, you're going to collect the money and build the base, and it's about being the strategist that outsmarts the enemy and all this sort of stuff. And then there's the formal elements, which is, you know, what do the inputs do that causes what to happen? When are you permitted to build a siege tank? How long does it take to build? What are its stats and these kinds of things? And getting these things to really both work together to create the same emotional experience is hard. You know, we were talking about this with StarCraft. Oh, I expect to be a commander. Nope, you are actually the organizer of a disorganization engine. That's the start of sitting down to play Brood War. Or, you know, in Street Fighter, the whole idea of, is it about combos? Is it about rock, paper, scissors? Is it about just being a cool badass who's able to throw out a bunch of really awesome moves? You know, there's all these different emotional expectations that you can go into the game with, that just don't actually match what's there. And I find that's like what's most interesting to me is a lot of the games that just go, fuck it. We're not really going to worry that much about the narrative. Like, well, welcome to League of Legends. The narrative is, there's lanes. Look, there's a field, okay? And think of this as think of something like MOBAs, League of Legends, Dota. It makes so little sense to think of it as something familiar. Like, StarCraft, you can think of as you're a commander of an alien force. In Dota, in League, one of the first things I always tell people is do not think of this as a typical game. Think of it as a sport. No one asks for the story of chess. Oh, let me say that. No one thinks about the story of football. No one thinks about the story of soccer. You're just presented with the field and the rules and all this sort of thing. And it's just really interesting as esports and competitive gaming are getting more and more and more and more popular. There's this little hurdle that these new games have to leap over, which is how do you get someone to first start playing and not have too much of a soured sense of expectations? Because I think that's the biggest reason why a lot of people stop playing any game. They expect it to be one thing, and it isn't. Like a Dark Souls, which is one of my favorite games of all time.
I love Dark Souls.
Oh, I hated it the first time I played it.
Really?
I hated it.
Well, okay, so when
I was expecting Zelda.
That's funny.
Evil kind of Zelda, and really, it's just not that. The problem is my expectations, you know, being aligned there.
The first one I played was Demon's Souls, and I actually just was confused. I thought I must not know how to play the game because I'm dying. I actually think I went on Twitter. It was a long time ago, and I said, am I doing something wrong here? Because
yeah,
I am dying immediately. I thought, did I get the wrong character build? And then people said, no, that's the game, and I went, oh, okay.
Yeah.
So this is going to be a real grind. To what we were talking about earlier, Dark Souls is sort of the game that's revolutionizing the way that people are looking at a lot of games because the game is intentionally hard and is not handing you anything. And it is actually going back to that original, in some ways, the Mario model, but fused in with a little bit of respawning. Right?
Yeah.
You can go to I know they all kind of operate slightly differently, but basically you go to the bonfire, this level will be the exact same thing every time. And there's a way you can do it and beat it while you're still level one, any weapon. People speed run it. People speed run it.
Yeah,
speed running is past tense of speed running. people can speed run the game. And the game has been incredibly well received. I haven't played Sekiro yet, but
It's okay.
I now that my hands are beginning to get a little bit better, I've been playing a little bit of Dark Souls Remastered. I got to wear these like arthritic gloves and stuff. I look like Michael Jackson. That's probably not a good person to look like right now. Excuse me. The arthritic gloves. I look like one of the burglars from Home Alone. Okay.
Okay.
Nobody wants to look like Michael Jackson right now.
That was close. Wow.
But yeah, I've been playing it a little bit, and it's really fun to get back into it. But that's sort of bringing back something that was an old feature, and then I think almost improving on it. Now, granted, that's a game that doesn't have much of a story at all. I kind of don't even really know what.
Oh, you don't know the story of Dark Souls. You don't read items like the pal Sean does.
No, I don't. I don't know it that well. I don't. But you don't need to. You can go through the whole game as long as you kind of have a rough idea of what the objectives are. It's cool to see that kind of come back. Do you feel like some of these older mechanics or features in games, because games were a lot harder in older times, is this going to become more and more common now? Because there was definitely a period where every game was spoon-feeding, particularly single-player games.
Yeah.
But I think we even saw this a little bit with some multiplayer games. I mean, League of Legends looked at the original Dota, the Warcraft 3 mod, and said, okay, if we water this down, if we simplify this a little bit, we can reach a lot of people, which they did. StarCraft 2, they...
Although it was very difficult to claim that League of Legends is a simple game.
No, it's an insanely hard game.
Yeah.
But, you know, they got rid of, you know, needing to have multiple control groups in StarCraft 2. And that also really it allowed a lot of people to come in.
Right.
And we've seen periods where games have been made easier and easier, but it seems like we're almost in a period where there's a pendulum swing back towards making it a little bit more difficult. Would you agree with that?
You know, I've spent a lot of time thinking about this topic, about the idea of the simplification of games. And this is as best as I can describe what I think is happening. This is my mental model for what's going on, which is, let's take what we were talking about earlier with StarCraft. On one hand, you are told, build stuff with a base, build workers with your economy, control your units. These are very commandery things. What's the emotion? What's the sort of satisfying emotional experience? It's like comboing in a rhythm game. Wow. That's kind of weird that trying to create this thing wound up creating that sort of experience. So I just want to set that aside, right? So there, that's the thing that's lying in the corner. In traditional design, when I'm talking about traditional design, I'm talking about product design. Like we're making a phone. There is a really common product loop that winds up happening, which is this product has issue X. Okay, how do we address it? We fix that, and the product's better. You know, for instance, the material that we made with the front screen, it's not picking up as well on the touch surface. So let's change that material. The edges actually dig into the fingers a little bit. Can we smooth the edges? Can we change that material? And so on and so on and so on. And it creates this loop of there was a pain, we removed the pain, and everyone's happy. And the problem is, what is a game? A game is a bunch of problems. The game is you overcoming the problems. So you wind up with this incredible
difficulty. I suppose that is the big difference between a game and then just role play.
Yeah.
I mean, we can role play and, you know, pretend that you're a wizard or anything. But yeah, if there's no problems, if there's no obstacles, whether they be a memorization obstacle, a mechanical obstacle, or anything else, without you cannot have a game without having problems that you're having to solve.
And problems and difficulties cause weird things to happen. Like if you take Dark Souls, imagine removing all enemies. Okay, it's a beautiful place to wander around in. But when there's enemies, like right now, I can picture Undead Burg perfectly. Every nook, every cranny, every corner, by creating this combat problem, suddenly the space becomes more real, more rich, more interesting. It stands out in my mind, and I can understand it, and I have a feel for it in a way that I wouldn't if they removed all the problems. And I think that this winds up being, you know, because I've been part of processes like this where you get a bunch of people like, this thing is too hard. And let's pick a video game at random here, StarCraft, right? Like, I think dealing with Reapers is too hard in the StarCraft II early game. Okay, let's try to make the Reapers a little weaker. You know what happens? Feels kind of good because I don't have to deal with the problem anymore. But again, a game is not necessarily about removing all the bad. It's kind of about creating a bunch of spikes, really positive feelings of hitting the next bonfire in Dark Souls, the agonizing frustration of barely not getting to the bonfire, even though you could see it in the distance. And it all these problems create these important emotional experiences that are very difficult in terms of a product pipeline. You can accidentally smooth out issues and problems that were creating some of the positive stuff. And I think that the choosing 12 units versus not choosing 12 units is a really interesting one because, I frankly just think for the sake of the genre, it's better to be able to select all your shit. Like, it feels so obvious. But you and I, as longtime Brood War players, know that there was something kind of special that was there. And it's not about what the right one is in that particular instance. It's not about is 12 units versus infinite unit selection the better choice in this context. The important point I want to convey is that it's really important to make sure you leave in enough problems, leave in enough of the obnoxious bullshit that maybe one person didn't like, because that actually is the game. That's what makes a game. And I think that what we're seeing in the last few years is this slow creep where there was a lot of smoothing and simplification and smoothing and cutting out of elements, making things more streamlined, which isn't bad. A lot of great games have come of that. But I think you're just seeing people intuitively start to go, wait, when I look back, wow, that game that I played 15 years ago, still the feeling that created, I don't have.
Yeah, I wonder, excuse me, I wonder if there's something about the presentation of the game itself that can be the problem. Because,
oh my God, yeah.
Because basically, you look at Dark Souls, right? Now, it's very difficult to play in so many different ways. But one thing that took me a long time to get the hang of in the game was I didn't realize I really needed to change my armor sets. I didn't realize I need to pay attention to the boss that's using
light. Oh, shit, you need to do that.
Yeah. It just seems to me like games are not presenting themselves in a way that shows you what that actual hidden aspect is. Like Dark Souls, I had to learn on my own about the armor sets. It took me forever. I didn't realize I need to put on a certain type of armor and then pay attention to the fact this guy has lightning attacks. And then I'll be able to not take so much damage, right? I was so used to in any RPG, I just pick up the new armor, put that on, and I might be wearing the wrong armor at the wrong time. And it seems like in, let's say, RTS games, if there was more of a tutorial to celebrate the mechanical part of the game, people would actually then not see it as a bug, but see it as a feature.
Yeah, and I think this is, you know, what we were talking about earlier. It's expectation management. The problem a lot of times is the mismatch between the expectation and the actuality. And I was playing this game recently called Void Bastards, and it's one of these roguelike games, and, you know, in case someone listening isn't familiar with that, it's a game where you're supposed to play a bit and you're supposed to die a lot, and then the entire experience will reset and you try again. It's about getting better and better and better at this ever-changing procedurally generated experience. And in the very first mission of the game, it creates a circumstance where you die no matter what. I mean, there might be some weird exploit to get out of it, but you die. And it actually has, like, a cutscene and a sequence where it explains to you that that's supposed to happen. That's totally fine. And then it talks about, you know, like, how there's going to be a new clone that's going to take the place. You know, it's a very funny, charming thing. But, again, there's this emotional problem that will happen. When I die, I go, ooh, well, that's bad. Either this game's bullshit or, God forbid, I'm bad at the game. And the game goes, nope, that's the point. Everyone dies. It's totally fine. And I feel like this is a sort of modern technique that is being explored a lot, which I think is really interesting. Like, okay, how do you not simplify the game? How do you not just leave the crazy complexity in the game? Let's not even worry about that angle. Let's just look at the good game and then say, how do we create some tutorial or some level or some experience that just sets expectations properly?
Yeah, because I've always found it interesting to try to show somebody else a game with their impression that it's a certain way. And then I guess it actually just is something totally different. Even in StarCraft 2,
yeah.
You know, people say, okay, I want to do this kind of rush. I want to do this strategy that I saw somebody do in like a GSL or some big WCS match. And, you know, I've spent a lot of my life just with people in my house and I'm telling them what to do when they play because, you know, I'm happy to show people the game. And there's always this moment where I'm saying, okay, make a probe. Okay, good. Hit E.
Yeah, make a probe.
Make a probe. And they're like, okay, but what, I mean, make another probe. Pylon, now. No. Pylon, now. And,
you know, I mean, it's like there's a stake, and if you don't take it off, it's going to get burned. Take that stake off. Hit E, you know?
Yeah. It's almost like you're trying to show somebody the basics. They don't know the basics of cooking, but they have this fancy idea of the food that they're going to make. And I feel like...
Look at the garnish.
And I feel like a lot of... there's games in general that have this problem. And I don't think everybody has to be, you know, have their hand held with everything. But I do find it interesting that you have to break someone in this mechanical way. And I think the mechanics are necessary in games, just like combos are necessary in fighting games. But there's not something more built in inside of a game that shows people that. And maybe when I used Dark Souls earlier, maybe that's not a great example because the whole game is supposed to be a massive undertaking. But,
yeah.
But.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because single-player games are designed for you to be able to beat them. It's not like Dark Souls is this game that has been beaten by only a small amount of people. Like, millions of people have beaten Dark Souls games.
Right. Yeah, even though it is so intimidating at first, there's absolutely a way you can navigate that to the very, very end. Do you feel like in future esports titles, this is something that's going to be sorted out more easily? Because it does seem like a lot of esports titles basically hand you something, and then you kind of, almost like it's an alien artifact, you're handed something, you kind of have to figure it out. They'll show you a few things, but a lot of it's, you have to go outside or make contact with other people.
Alien artifact is such a funny description.
That's what I felt like using a game we used earlier, Street Fighter 4. Like, it didn't even have all the combos you could do in the game. I thought, okay, I actually have to just go on the internet. I have to do all the heavy lifting myself.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's if we want to use the term esports, and not competitive gaming or e-gaming,
E-gaming.
Yeah. E-gaming. Yeah, by the way, for any of you listening, never.
Never say e-gaming.
Never say e-gaming.
That
oh
is
my
the
God,
moment
don't.
You've been exposed as a phony. I do so much consulting work, and they start asking me about e-gaming, and I have to say, you mean like electronic game, like computer games?
Yeah.
What are you talking about, e-gaming?
What the fuck is an e-gaming?
Isn't that because, I think we talked about this off camera, but isn't that because gambling took the word gaming?
Yeah.
A lot of gambling places want to be called gaming places because gaming's a more innocuous word. So then when it came to actual gaming, people had to say e-gaming. I say fuck gambling and all that. We're taking that word back. Just gaming.
Yes.
Fuck those guys. Fucking e-gaming. What does it even mean?
Okay, but anyways, like if we're going to use the term e-sports,
yeah,
I think there's something interesting to note about what a lot of traditional sports do in terms of their presentation, where they will say, here is a game of basketball. Cool. Let's talk about drills. Isn't it interesting that you don't hear the word drills spoken about in any game, period?
Oh, that's a good point.
You don't hear that. Like you constantly have all sorts of drills about, okay, we're just going to do a passing drill. Okay, you know, and then we're going to spend some time just working on three-point shooting from just this angle in just this circumstance. You know, there's starting to be, I shouldn't say there's starting to be, there are some that exist. Last hit training in Dota. Great. Cool.
Yeah, CSGO has something like that where you can run through a stage and shoot at various figures. It's to get your aim up. Off the top of my head, I can't remember what it's called, but something like that in there.
Even that, my understanding is that those are sort of like community-created things.
And I believe so, yeah.
And I feel like there is this sort of third element to games that could be explored, which is you got the single player, you got the multiplayer. But maybe there's this in-between thing of drills, you know, just like, okay, you're going to be in this situation where you need to learn in Counter-Strike to throw a grenade here. Let's explore different grenade angles that can solve this problem. And then you go through a drill a bunch of times, and you have to discover the right angle to throw the flashbang to cause this player to be blinded, and the right angle to throw this Molotov to prevent a sniper from staying in that back position, you know? And there's these drills that could be incorporated that I really think would go a long way to helping with expectation management. Because, you know, if you sat one of your friends down with StarCraft and you said, okay, you want to play, that's great. Look at these 70 drills that deal with 70 different things. Maybe they don't touch more than 5 of them, but at least that frames for them that there are actually 70 different fundamental mechanical elements to the game that they better at least consider becoming good at. Otherwise, they don't get to play the game.
I've been learning chess, and I use chess.com, the app. If anybody wants to pick up chess, the app, especially if you pay a little bit of extra cash to unlock all the features, is amazing. But built into it, they have every possible lesson, every possible opener. So that's all. It's there. It's all accessible. And I think when you see these community-based, like let's say drills or like, as StarCraft players, we know I have to go up against a computer and I just practice my initial opening. Doesn't matter what the computer's going to do. I'm not going to lose to it, but I need to make sure I have that pattern mapped out, right? It would probably be so much more helpful if these were just built into more esports. And I know there's some stuff that's there, but I feel like there's so much more that you could give. Now, that being said, in fairness and defense of some of these games, a lot of times games that are released as esports, they've not been mapped out at all. So maybe those features are impossible to implement on some level, but I think it would be better and better if there was more stuff there so that someone can kind of stumble upon the game and all the things are there to pick it up. I think Tekken 7 did this incredibly. They have their own training mode where you can figure out almost anything in that game and get it mapped out. But I think a lot of other games don't have that yet.
Word. Gosh, Nick, I just want to say yes. Yes. Nick and I, we have both hands up in the air like, woo, we're the best. We figured it out. We solved esports.
Hey, everyone. Melty here. Just going to interrupt for a very brief ad break. And we do have Charlie Sheaver and John Kernicki as our two patrons who are going above and beyond. We want to give a special shout out to them. Thank you both so much. We really appreciate you guys helping us out. It does mean a lot. And also to all of our other patrons, we do really appreciate you as well. You guys, all of you together, we wouldn't be able to do this without you guys. And this includes not only the patrons, thank you all again, but the viewers, the listeners, you guys, do appreciate you. You guys are really helping us out. Without, you know, everyone listening, you know, we wouldn't really have a reason to put it on if no one listened. Of course, we have recently rearranged our patron goals. We now have, we've moved the AMA to 50 patrons, and then since we're super close, we wanted to get that in sooner rather than later. And we also have a video camera now at 100 patrons, and then a special multi-person podcast at 150. Those are the current goals. If we could really stretch to reach them, I think it'd be really awesome. And it'd also mean a lot to us here at the Tases podcast. And I think I've said patron enough times. I will say at least one more time. If you have the financial means to do so, please consider supporting us on patreon.com/tastelesspodcast. It does mean a lot if you haven't already. Although, of course, if you just listen, that does help, since every listener does count. And now I think that is enough, and so you guys can get back to listening to Day 9 and Tasteless.
What were we talking about?
I don't know. We basically just, I feel like, culminated with the, we think that esports can be presented better with drills. Or not drills, but be presented better with things that manage the expectation of players as they're stepping in.
So, when we were kids, we started going to StarCraft tournaments. This is right at the very beginning of any kind of... the beginning of any kind of esports tournament. It was nothing like what you would see now, with stages and lights and actual refs.
Gosh.
But what was the first tournament we actually went to together? It was in...
there. I mean, there was the WCG 2001? Or 2002?
Were we in St. Louis for this?
No, this was the one that Mom flew us out to Los Angeles, and we went to some LAN cafe.
Yeah, and it was weird because, like, I was at that age where I'm embarrassed that people know I have a mom. I don't know if that makes any sense. You know when you're like, your mom picks you up from elementary school, and somehow, yeah, I was that kid who was like, oh my God, it's my mom. I'm like somehow so embarrassed. Like, everybody else's mom and dad is picking them up. But yeah, she was at the tournament with us.
Yeah.
And that was I think it was in Koreatown in Los Angeles. That was the first one we went to. Right,
I think that's definitely the first one that we traveled to. I mean, it's plausible that there was like a LAN. No, I don't even.
That
think
has to be the first one, right?
That has to be the first one.
What was that like for you? Going to that tournament, you did fairly well. I believe you beat Maynard in one game, not the StarCraft II Maynard. There's a couple Maynards in StarCraft history, but there was a very good player.
Yeah, no,
named
I mean, I would go 100-0 against the StarCraft II Maynard. Okay, can we just say that right now? Can we make sure that gets into the podcast now?
But the Maynard that you beat.
Okay, let's okay, it's history time. Okay.
Yeah.
How many workers does it take to saturate a base in StarCraft 2? 16. 2 per mineral patch. If you build 30 workers in your main, and then when your expansion finishes and you transfer 14 over to leave 16 in the main, you have 14 there, you jumpstart on the expansion. What's that called? A Maynard exchange. This is because the first player that widely did this was a player from Texas, like Miguel Bombach, something like that. He would overbuild workers and do the Maynard exchange, and he did it several times at that tournament. I remember people sitting behind him going, like, oh, it's a Maynard exchange. Maynard is doing the Maynard exchange.
Yeah.
And
he went to Korea as well for a little bit.
Yeah, no,
and trained out there.
He was in the era where XDS Gur was in Korea. Maynard went there for, what was it,
I think Orky Otter was there as well. There's a bunch of players that aren't really... Guillaume Petri, XGS Gur, is quite big now in Korea. He's just a celebrity on TV. But yeah, there was a whole period of players that weren't really remarked on that much because the game was so...
Yeah.
Pillars as well, who actually very briefly worked on StarCraft 2 before it was released.
Yeah, and I mean, when I was at that tournament, I somehow amazingly won my way through the upper bracket to meet in the winner's bracket semifinals, where if you win that... you're in top three and you're guaranteed to go to Korea. And the very first game, I lost. I don't remember what happened. The second game, I did hold position lurkers. Now, if you don't know this is where you burrow the lurkers and you can disable their auto attack.
Yeah, and you have an overlord selected in there.
And then a bunch of Marines roll up. You just blow all of them up. And I did it. And I remember being like, oh my God, I'm going to go to Korea. And I mean, it's amazing how unimaginably bad I was at this game.
But everybody was. Everybody didn't know what they were doing. I mean, if you look at old, even StarCraft 2, man, if you go to the first two seasons of GSL, I mean, what the fuck were they doing?
Dude, even the maps, you look at the maps, you're like, who, what bastard created this map? What moron plays this horrible map this horrible way?
Yeah, it's always worth pointing out in RTS especially that, I mean, we all stand on the shoulders of giants, right? But yeah, I mean, the way people were playing back then, if you go back and show somebody, it can be quite embarrassing.
Well, it's funny too, because like, if you take something like Counter-Strike, you aim, you shoot. And I do think that over time, players' overall aim has gotten better and players are able to pull off better plays. But imagine if players just didn't aim in 2001. Like, that's what it feels like when you go look back at StarCraft. It's not that they were doing something a little worse than they did now. It's that they're doing something wrong. It was all wrong. And I remember in the third game, so all games at this WCG were played on a map called Lost Temple. One of the things that people, I think, say all the time about StarCraft is this game was never balanced. It was a perfect game. They didn't balance it in 20 years. They balanced it all the time. That's what the maps were. The maps changed the balance constantly. They didn't change the units. They changed how the formation of the terrain and what the resources were, which, by the way, are way more important than the units and the strategy that you're doing. It's all about where the resources are and how to defend them. And Lost Temple was the first modern StarCraft map. All StarCraft maps since then, all StarCraft II maps, even the single players of StarCraft II were heavily influenced by the architecture of Lost Temple, which did things that you would think of as very automatic now. You had a main base with one entrance.
Right.
You had a second base called your natural that had the same amount of resources as in your main. That also had one entrance, but it was a little harder to defend. You had a second natural that would often have two entrances. And that those three bases formed a really stable way to get bases. Because, you know, in other maps, you'd start with your main base, and it was impossible to get a second. It was, like, impossible. You'd start off, you'd be screwed on that. And Lost Temple also had another aspect to it, which has since kind of died out, which is that each position architecturally was quite different.
Yeah, it was not symmetrical.
Yeah, like it was deeply asymmetrical, but it did have this theme of the natural and the second natural. And I remember in that third game, I spawned in the left position, which is the worst position for Zerg, because it has this weird, you know, sort of snaky path from your main base to your second base, and you just can't get your units there in time to defend anything.
That's right.
Yeah.
There was also the bullshit 12 o'clock and 3 o'clock position where if the Terran was at the 3 o'clock and any other race was at 12 o'clock, they could get tanks in their main and then
kill the geyser.
And not only that, you could basically stop them from getting out of the ramp that exited their main.
Oh, my God. No, you're talking about 3 versus 12. Oh, yeah, 3 versus 12.
Is,
and 12
is that what I said?
Well, there was bullshit in both directions, because if you were in the top position against the right position...
Oh, my God, no, you're right. Okay,
that's right.
We're talking about the positions being swapped. Yeah, I forgot. Yeah, if it was switched around and there was a Terran, then he could hit your guys.
So you say your thing, I'll say my thing.
Yeah. No, basically, yeah, if you were a Terran player and you were at 3 and whatever race was at 12, you could put it from your main, that you could get an angle where you could hit their ramp. It's just a shit setup.
Yeah.
And then
if you were in 12... you could actually sneak siege tanks to this weird position that was kind of in the top right void area.
It was like a weird island-like area.
Yeah. You could put a siege tank there, and you could kill their gas geyser. And in StarCraft 1, you only had one gas geyser in your main. And gas was the it resource. It was the Bitcoin of StarCraft 1, man. You wanted gas, let me tell you. Like, you just wound up with this map that was kind of a mess, but was still the most compelling, interesting one of them all. And that entire tournament was so interesting as just this complete disorganized mess of players who'd gotten various names and popularity in certain areas. And, you know, I think there's only one thing that I actually remember of that. Well, I guess there's two things. One is that the Terran player Froz, who to this day is a player that I admire more than almost any player in any esport in my life.
He's a great player.
We're going to come back to him in a moment. But the only other thing I remember is when there was a player whose name was Requiem. It was Requiem, but he was so young when he created the ID that he'd spelled it wrong. And he just rolled
with
it.
Oh, my God.
His name was Requiem, okay? And he was a friend of Froz. Now, to go a little out of order, Froz eventually won the whole tournament first place, and Froz went on to become the most famous North American player until day nine.
Until day nine showed
That's
up.
Right. Is this the plot family podcast thing? Day nine wound up being the
This is the plot propaganda
greatest.
Podcast. Yeah, we can say you. Whatever we want here.
Thank you, Nick. It's such a pleasure to be here. yeah, so Requiem was Frost's friend, and Frost said to everyone, he's like, I actually think Requiem's the best player here. He's the only player who can beat me consistently. And Requiem played against a famous Zerg player named Dream. And they played. I think it was a quick game one, a pretty solid game two that Requiem won. And then it was tied 1-1. And they just played like a 55-minute long, insane match. I mean, and most Brood War games in that era were like 9 to 11 minutes long. They were very short, swift. I didn't know what I was doing. He showed up with units. I died. See you in the next match. It was like 55-minute long. The whole tournament stopped. Like, even the tournament organizer stopped paying attention to what was happening in the brackets and just watched this game because Dream was one of the favorites of the tournament. And Dream lost and got up and just started yelling at Requiem. Do you remember this? He just
very vaguely
he stood up and he just like, you play like such a pansy. You
oh
suck.
Oh my God.
At this
no,
game.
No, I do remember this.
You don't know how to play Zerg. You don't know how to play.
It was just moment of actual insanity.
He lost control. And I remember he was pulling cigarettes out of his pocket and he's putting cigarettes in his mouth and trying to light it. And you could see it was such
a good game too. It was like God, this weird thing where the game was so beautiful that normally when two players finish a game like that, there's almost a moment of like romance between the two guys. Like, wow,
we
that was
art.
Us.
Yeah.
We made art. But yeah, you can't replicate a game like that. And instead, this guy, he got up and started berating the guy. Now, I just, in defense of this guy, everybody was very young.
I mean,
I want to say this guy was like 16 years old or something.
No, he was absolutely not close to being done with high school, right?
He was a kid. But yeah, I don't want anybody to be judged too harshly for whatever the fuck happens in high school. But go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, I feel obligated to say dumb shit that I thought in high school. Like, I liked math. And I was like, people who don't like math aren't as smart as I am. Like, I thought bullshit like this when I was in high school. Okay. But he lost his mind. And I was like, oh my God. And it was scary because, like, I mean, I'm 33. I said 32 earlier in the podcast, but I forgot I just had my birthday. Happy birthday to me. I'm 33.
Happy birthday, Sean.
I'm 33, and I still don't like conflicts that much, right? And I definitely, when
totally.
I was 14, I did not. I was just, oh, my God. Like, there was part of me that was like, what do I do? Like, should I call the police? I was freaking out. And then I had to play Requiem next match, and I burrowed a bunch of Zerglings in his base and just kept unburrowing him, killing a probe, and burrowing, and unburrowing and killing a probe, and burrowing. And I could hear laughter around me while this was happening, and unburrowing and killing a probe, and burrowing. By the way, in case any of you are surprised, there is an upgrade in StarCraft 1 called Burrow, which to this day, fucking zero people use.
No, they're doing it in KSL now.
Except in the last season of KSL.
Yeah,
it took 20 some odd years until Burrow was researched.
Years. But I was, when they were doing that, there's a little asterisk here, but yeah, when they started doing it, I thought, yeah, of course people should have been doing that more often, you know? But I think people got caught up in the macro part of the game that some of these abilities got ignored.
Okay, no, I actually, listen, we're suddenly going to get into a technical argument, but I need to talk to you about Burrow in the early game as Zerg. Because you know, we were just talking about 12 versus 3 Lost Temple. Losing gas sucks. Zerg early game revolves around two things that are absolutely fundamental. The first is getting a lair, which is like your ticket to building all your interesting units that matter. The second is Zergling speed, which you need to be able to do anything defensively at the start of the game.
That was also the only way you could guarantee killing a scouting worker.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, thank you.
When you get to any technical part, denying the scout is actually what the game is. Because if you're at any high level, then the guy who scouts you is actually looking at what you're doing inside of your base.
Yeah. No. Like people get upset about map hacks and like Counter-Strike and Overwatch and shit.
Yeah.
You build those as your starting unit in StarCraft.
Yeah.
You build a little probe that like sails around here and can teleport through things. So when you try to get Burrow is a third 100 gas thing at the start of the game, and Burrow is stronger the earlier you are in the game.
At that time,
if you're listening to the Tasteless podcast, I'm not going to fucking explain the StarCraft mechanics to you. You need to play StarCraft, listener. If you don't get with it, yeah. So like Burrow was this upgrade that the later on in the game you got, the worse it was because there's more detection, there's more map control, things like this. So the earlier you got it, the better. And just trying to figure out how to not get Zergling speed and get Burrow. and then you don't have any defense and you get scouted infinitely, or maybe delaying your lair so that way you can get... I mean, it's very hard to find when you could even do it, because in StarCraft, all the decisions you make in the first 3 minutes of the game have repercussions up to 30 minutes into the game. So the fact that anybody did something clever with Burrow in KSL was just remarkable. Like, efforts... Zerglings. I was shook when I saw him using Burrow so effectively.
Yeah, it was insane. It's cool to see that people have really kind of are continuing. Well, I should say people are continuing to map that game out and unpack it for what it is. But going back to this tournament you were at, so then you killed Requiem.
Oh yeah, I killed Requiem.
Now when you were playing him, were you nervous? Were you excited? Did you feel anything at all? Because you and I have had a little bit of a difference when we were younger in our experience at tournaments. I think that in that I had more performance anxiety than you. And that's not to say that you were like a stone cold killer, but you definitely were able to deliver better results. Like, I would practice, but I always felt out of my element. I don't have this when I try to compete against people in whatever game I'm playing in now, but I definitely had this hurdle I had to overcome. And, I was wondering if you had any insight into that.
Nick, I have a lot of insight into that.
What is it?
I'm ready to share it with you. So I feel like anyone who's listening knows that feeling of when you're playing a game and you feel different than when you're just going through your normal life. Something changes, and maybe it's a hyper-anxiety where you start to lose control over the order you're pressing the buttons in the fighting game. Or it's a state of flow where you're razor focused, or it's you're so nervous. You know, it's well documented that when people get really full of adrenaline and anxiety, they start to get tunnel vision, right? And in StarCraft, you need to pay attention to the mini map that's at the far bottom left corner of the screen. And the most common trait in anxiety is, the most common trait in anxious StarCraft players is I don't pay attention to the mini map. I miss really basic stuff that's moving around. And I feel like all these different mental states are sort of like grooves in wood. If you just keep trying to push yourself into the state, it starts to get more and more comfortable and regular. And I felt like with StarCraft, there were two states that I would push to try to get to. Or I should say there are two states that I regularly gotten to, and one that I really actually wanted as my destination. One was sort of like hyper... out of control. I mean, imagine just, a 12-year-old on Surge for the first time. It was just like, wah, where my fingers are moving fast, but it's a chaotic mess. There's no organization. And the other one is like razor sharp flow. And I remember as a kid, I would always think I need to be quick of hand and slow of brain. That's the best description I can have of being in a flow state. I can think really slowly about what I'm doing and what my plan is, but my hands are moving very, very, very fast. For anyone who didn't know, I was a very, very fast StarCraft 1 player.
One of the things I wanted to bring up briefly was that you took piano lessons, and you had to play the piano in front of audience. I was curious because, I mean, the configuration of sitting down and using your hands and concentrating and following a pattern and having that experience in piano. And I know that you were you did not like those piano recitals as a kid.
I did not like
it. But I'm wondering, hold on a second. So this Sean would fucking flip out before and after his piano recitals.
Yes.
Let me
give you a short answer first.
Yes.
My piano recitals had fucking nothing to do with StarCraft, but I do need to tell when I played Flight of the Bumblebee and cried.
Yeah, you had a melt. Now, see, I'm going to disagree with you here on this, because I'm wondering if you had your. I mean, you were actually, I think, very talented at playing the piano, but I don't think it was something that necessarily interested you in the same way that something like StarCraft did. But I'm just wondering if maybe, because what you essentially were experiencing, Sean's laughing very hard right now. His face is red. But you were experiencing some type of performance anxiety. But then when you got to go to StarCraft tournaments, I think because you had had the experience of being a little kid and having to go to those fucking piano recitals, that maybe that made you more in tune. Because, and what's also weird about this is we both do public speaking, but we didn't necessarily have much of an early background in that.
And I still get like not all the time, but sometimes I just get flooded with crippling stress and adrenaline while I'm like live on air. And you know, okay, so
I want to talk about that. I want to talk about that in a little bit, but just to keep us on course here. But I'm curious if that maybe whether you've thought about it or not, the fact that you had to experience the trauma of doing that and maybe not hitting a key, and then you get to go to another event where even though it's weird and you have again a similar experience, you're sitting down, you're using both hands, you're following a pattern, and you have an audience that is aware of around you of what you're trying, and they know what you're trying to do, and they're watching, and essentially whether you like it or not, they're kind of judging you. If that helped you, because for me, my first moment of real anxiety, in any kind of performance setting, not like a bully's picking on me or something, but for me, I sat down and I was so fucking distracted and freaked out, and I remember just feeling people around me. I remember someone was, this is all, by the way, this was all done when you were sitting in a computer cafe at a tournament. It wasn't like there was a stage, okay? And so I even had somebody who was kind of leaning on my chair. And it did not occur to me to tell this guy to back the fuck off.
Oh, my
gosh, I had my legs kind of pushing into the ground. And people are literally crowded around you.
Oh, and the guy whose leg is shaking, so your chair is shaking. Like,
yeah,
oh my God.
Yeah. And so I had this whole experience of being disoriented. I mean, even when you mentioned the thing about Dream, I think I was so in shock after getting knocked to the loser's bracket. That was something that I had to dig out of my memory when you brought it up, because I was out of my element. I was sort of freaked out and weirded out. And I mean, eventually over time, I improved on that and I had success in tournaments. But to bring it full circle, do you think that had any help at all?
Yeah, you know, okay, so I was talking about these different grooves of sort of hyper-focus and then like being in the zone. There's this mantra that actually mom said to me when I was very, very, very young, because there was a girl and I had a crush on her. And I wouldn't even say I asked her out. I basically like stammered a bunch, and I actually threw up. I threw up like right in front of her, like because I was so nervous.
Did you ever throw up at StarCraft tournaments?
No.
Just
in front of my one true love in fifth grade.
I used to puke at a lot of tournaments before the important match. And then I
puke as an adult when I'm stressed.
Of course.
Yeah. You know,
we're like
family
fucking
tradition.
Chihuahuas or something like.
Yeah, no,
too much stimulation.
So you know, I remember I was talking to mom in like fifth grade, like, what do I do? She doesn't like me, and I remember mom said something to me, which is, it's not about trying to be cool, it's about being comfortable with uncomfortable emotions, and that really stuck with me. And you know, you talk about piano, but it was true. I did a whole bunch of math competitions as a kid where you'd like go and you'd have like 11 minutes to do a bunch of math problems. And then they'd just tell you that you were an idiot. And like, I didn't win anything. I used to do spelling bees. I still remember spelling the word haggard wrong. And I mean, like in my round, it was like apple, chair. And then they were like haggard and I got it wrong. So I was out in like the first round and I was like, I couldn't handle it. I just would always think about how do I become comfortable with uncomfortable emotions? Because you feel overwhelmed, your fingers tingle when you're in an event. Like, you're not used to that, where you're sitting down and you have so much adrenaline coursing through your body that your fingers and your toes suddenly have this electricity in them that you're not used to. It's okay. Just become comfortable with uncomfortable emotions. And I used to spend a lot of time, not leading up to that tournament in 2001, where I still remember the feeling that I had, which was absolute abject panic. But in tournaments since then, I would just think about how do I become comfortable? How do I become comfortable? What makes me comfortable? I need to be more comfortable just with the uncomfortable emotions. And that's why I say that those are the two grooves that I would wind up in as a player, this frenetic out of control-ness. And then how do I just get more comfortable? Like there were things I used to do. I used to have a timer set on my phone. No, not on my phone. Those didn't exist in the 2000s. I used to have a timer on my computer.
The smartphone. Yeah.
Every 2 minutes.
Our family was Amish. No, sorry.
Yeah. No. Every 2 minutes, I would have my computer just go bing. And that would remind me to relax my shoulders.
Oh, I like that idea.
I used to make myself look at the mini map, not with my eyes, but by turning my head down to the bottom, by looking like this. Because, again, if you're feeling really anxious and you've trained your body to turn and look at the mini map, you will now see it. Whereas if you try to look with your eyes, it's very easy to, again, be stressed out and get tunnel vision and forget that the mini map exists. And I feel like a lot of those early experiences of just being in like hyper stressful environments and just trying to think through that mantra, how do I become comfortable with uncomfortable emotions and get in the zone? Because part of the reason your body's flooded with stress is because you're stressed. Part of the reason is because you're excited. And that feeling you have in your body is not truth. You feel like shit. Every time I've ever played in a tournament, I feel horrible. Right? Like there is no joy when the countdown's happening. Like,
really?
Oh no.
I feel like now I'm in a phase where if I can compete, I'm always pretty much okay.
Well, the thing is that like this is a weird example, but I feel like it's so important to clarify my point. Have you ever had anyone who, if you've ever had shit with, you've ever gotten in an argument or anything, you just know it's going to be good because this person is just so calm and good at listening and stuff like that. So it makes you feel less stressed around the person. And then there's that person that every time you get into an argument, they just escalate as much as possible and things go off the rails. And so when you're around them, everything's fine, but you feel like, I feel like this is what I mean by the comfortable with uncomfortable emotions. Like when I see that countdown, I don't feel good. But, you know, it's fine. It's actually it's a fine experience. The experience is going to be okay. I know that it's going to be fun in the end. I know we're going to have fun playing. And I can actually get past the horrible bone-crushing anxiety part and quickly get to the joyous excitement adrenaline-fueled part.
That's really interesting. I sort of had this thing. For me to adapt to that, I sort of built myself up as and it is in a comical way, but as a legend in my head of like, all right, here we're back. like I always thought of when I laddered as this like thankless journey of fucking slaying thousands of nerds, like some kind of like I was built to destroy each nerd that was in my path. And I thought about it in a very funny way, but I sort of halfway took it seriously. Like I imagine myself almost like I'm some kind of samurai or something, you know, that I've shown up in this part of town and I'm here to destroy these dishonorable nerds. But I always thought about that. And I think the halfway humorous part
of
it,
the Yojimbo of Brood War.
I had this the humor of it would alleviate stress because I'm not taking myself that seriously. But the fun idea of what I'm kind of the funny thought experiment of it would kind of get me in a good mood. Yeah. And so I tried to do that. So obviously now we're both public speakers, which is, that's kind of a surprise, that we both ended up doing,
that's so weird
going on. Cause I never felt like I'm a guy that can or should go on stage or
can I ask you for a favor?
Yeah.
Okay. I want to actually ask you for a favor here.
Yes.
Can you confirm that in high school, I was actually pretty quiet?
Let's think here. You were more quiet in middle school and elementary school.
Oh, and no, I was. You were essentially, I opted in. I was like a Shaolin monk who played with Legos.
Yeah, you were very, very shy as a kid. Very good in school. I was the kid that was always not doing his homework. I don't know what the deal was with me as a kid. I remember they gave me homework in first grade. They gave me this paper and they said, all right, go home and fill. There's like five questions. Go home and fill this out. And I remember thinking, I'm not going to do this shit. I don't know why. I thought, no, I'm not. I'm not going to do that. So I was always in trouble. I wasn't like I was a bad kid. I wasn't getting in fights or anything.
No, that's the interesting thing.
But I didn't
like,
want to do school. I didn't want to be there. By late high school, I was sleeping in some of my classes. I was totally checked out. I did actually well in college, even though I eventually left to go to Korea. But no, I was always the kid who was kind of in trouble. Like I had a lot of bad grades and I was sort of, I don't know, all of my school was, I kind of didn't know how to be there. You were the kid who was very academic and studious. And I felt like you got more social in high school. I remember thinking that you were actually getting pretty funny. I remember thinking, oh, Sean's funny.
No.
Now. Yeah, you would say stuff and I'd go, oh, that's pretty good.
No, like I dude, high school for me, like, I mean, cause for any of you who don't know, Nick hasn't been funny once on this podcast, but, but Nick is actually the funniest human being on the planet Earth. Like if you ever
Thank
go
you,
out,
Sean.
Yeah, no, listen. I was the best Brood War player. You're the funniest guy on earth. Is that our exchange? Is that
that's the deal? That's where we shake hands. All right.
Yeah, we're just giving each other a nod. Yeah, no, like, Nick is actually the funniest human in the universe. And that was still true when I was, like, 13. So, I mean, like, you know, Mom was a very gregarious, big storyteller, you know, and she would never speak about anything blandly ever. Even just, like, making coffee was, like, a tale with Mom. And then Nick was, like, really, really funny and would be able to just entertain adults that Mom would have over and stuff. And I was like, okay, I'm going to give it a try. Here we go.
Here we go, everybody.
Oh, here we go. It's going to be my turn.
Here's my piano music I've practiced.
And so that's so interesting to me that you actually saw me in that way.
No, you had a good sense of humor, and it was a little bit different than what I had.
I found a lot of stuff funny. I enjoy laughing. To this day, I enjoy laughter, Nicholas.
No, I mean, the thing is, we're actually from a pretty funny family in general, I'd say. I mean, I don't know how to communicate with people that can't laugh.
That's weird.
You know, when you're just...
Yeah.
No, with an entire group of boring people, and you'll make a joke, and it was some fucking good material, and nobody even reacts as if it was a joke. They're kind of like, huh.
Oh, look at that.
So, I remember you being more social in high school, but high school was when... Because we went to public school for elementary and middle school. I know some people who are listening to this that had, you're in first grade up to eighth grade, and then you go to a different school. We had this middle school, seventh grade, eighth grade. And then we went to all-boy Catholic high school. And that was when I became not only a terrible student, which I always was, but not engaged in the school at all.
Yeah.
I hated Rockers High School in Kansas City. It was just not fun. Yeah,
let us refer to it by name. Yeah, I mean, I will.
Some kid from Rockers High School is going to hear this too.
Yeah,
nothing that happens in high school matters at all. I got a good education there, but
yes,
I did not connect with it. So I might have also been regressing in my own way there. Yeah. So maybe me seeing you being more social, because to this day I haven't actually kept in touch really with anybody from high school.
The instant I went to college. Didn't speak to a single person there. You know, I had such a hard time at Rockhurst because, you know, you talked about the education. It was good education. And there's a number of teachers there who, unbelievable. Like Mr. Hagedorn is still to this day one of the greatest inspirations of my entire life.
Wow.
You know what? We're going to talk about this. Mr. Hagedorn was the first person who, in my entire educational career.
I'm so sorry. I actually don't remember this guy at all. Am I supposed to know this guy? Or just a teacher that you had?
He was a teacher. So,
okay, you know,
he was not like a legend. There wasn't just like the burning horns of Mr. Hagedorn in front of school or anything. He was an English teacher. And I mean, like, I was really into math, but, you know, still this teacher, he was the first teacher I ever had who spoke about things in a way that went, yeah, that's exactly like StarCraft. Because, you know, we started playing StarCraft in sixth grade. We were playing online in seventh and eighth grade. And... like any person who first plays a multiplayer game, someone kicks the shit out of you, and you go, what? That's not supposed to happen. I'm a smart person, and you're getting owned, and the person's being mean to you, and you have to have this moment where you go, I'm bad at this thing. Mr. Hagedorn would say, okay, you're gonna write a paper. I'm going to tell you what you need to write, what the topic is, what the sort of box that you're working within is. And if you do a good job, if you write about the required topic and sort of refer to what we've discussed in class, you're going to get a C. Because a C means you did fine. And if you impressed me and brought up points I was not expecting, it was well written, you'll get a B. And if you write something that I wish I'd written myself, you're going to get an A. And so every time he would say, like, hey, there's an essay due. Bunch of kids would turn in their essays, and in his three or four classes, like, three kids would get A's. And he wasn't shitty about it. If you got a C, he wouldn't go, you're an idiot, try harder, you suck. You know, he would go, you got a C, you basically did it. But it was this weird framing thing where I was like, yeah, that sounds right. This is the way the real world works. School kind of presents this. Everyone gets an A. Everyone's a gold medalist. Especially now.
Yeah.
Especially. And StarCraft was this game that where I was getting my teeth kicked in by people who were probably like 20 And I'm like a 14-year-old, and there was a truth to playing StarCraft that resonated with me. And I'd have Mr. Hagedorn just talk about writing properly. And he would give just harsh feedback, but not meanly. He wouldn't be like, you're dumb. He'd be like, this sentence, this is literally cut this sentence in your essays better. I mean, anyone who writes a sentence like this is going to drop a grade. And then you'd cut those types of sentences and you'd go, oh my God, well, this actually feels better. And he would do things where he'd go, you know what? You guys all wait till the last day to write your essays. You have an essay due tomorrow.
And, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it was something like, you know, we had, over the course of a year, we'd have something like 50 or 60 essays or something ridiculous. Which, on one hand, you'd go, why isn't it 1 week per essay? You know, why isn't it spread out? Well, maybe we skip an essay. And we'd like come in on days and turn in an essay. And you'd be like, all right, we're doing an in-class essay about a completely different topic. Go. And it was just like a write. And I really think that the entire foundation to how I speak in the Day 9 dailies, which I used to do, but now I'm washed up, so I don't do them anymore. you know, the Day 9 dailies where I would just do educational content about StarCraft is rooted mostly in his education and his tutelage. And I said 60% him and 40% trying to write papers in math when I was at Harvey Mudd. I mean, he was amazing. And everything else about Harvey Mudd, or excuse me, everything else about Rockhurst sucked dick.
I was in this weird spot because for me in the essays, I had this teacher named Mr. Wickenhauser.
I had him sophomore year. That guy's amazing.
And he was great. But I was writing all my papers on StarCraft at the time because that's what interested me. And, you know, that's when he said, he told the class, okay, write about something that interests you. But I think what I was writing about was so obtuse and so weird and I think so peculiar to him. He eventually told me to stop doing that, but he was a good teacher. But I was, you know, I was a kid who was, for most of his classes, not doing his homework, kind of checked out of school.
Yeah.
I ended up getting put, and Rockhurst High School is like this bro jock.
Oh, it's
like
it's
tuck your shirt in, country
every
club
teacher's
school.
Coach.
So, yeah, that's what I was actually about to get to, is that every teacher, especially in the low-tier academic-wise programs, every teacher was a coach, and a lot of them just did not really care that much about the subject matter, you know, or they would show it a lot of interest in the kids who played sports. And so I was not in an environment I thought where I could really get fostered that much. Now, that being said, I was just constantly not doing homework or constantly sleeping in class because I'd stayed up all night playing StarCraft. But
oh God, that was so stressful.
It was, no, it didn't work for me at all. I want to go back to something we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
About we're both public speakers now.
Yeah.
Now we were talking about kind of tournament anxiety, and I found this interesting to talk to various people because, in a weird way, we're actually performers, even though I don't think about it that way, but you know, we go on stage or we present, or we do, you know, live shows. Or we're doing this recording right here that people are going to be listening to maybe at their computer while they're playing games, or maybe they're driving
back
their car
right now. Of course, we're running 5 miles without
stopping.
That's
right. I'm balancing on a ball this entire time. So I'm curious. Do you still have any type of nervousness or anxiety, or did you have more or less when you started, and where are you at now? And before we go to that, I'm going to pee, so we're going to take a short break. And then we'll come back with that. Okay, guys, that does it for part one. That was a lot of fun. It's so cool getting to catch up with my little brother. I really don't get to see him that much at all anymore because we're both working so much and traveling, and obviously I live overseas. So, again, thank you so much, Sean, for sitting down and taking the time to chat with me. And if you guys are not familiar with him, what the fuck is wrong with you? Get on that. He's got a lot of great content over at Twitch. So get out there and check that out. And we'll be back with part two with my little brother Day 9 in 2 weeks as usual. This podcast was produced by Melty, artwork by Alarise, music by Mark Lentz. Thanks so much for joining us, guys. Again, support us at patreon.com/tastelesspodcast. Please, we'll be back in 2 weeks.
I love you all. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Oh, my God. Did you hear that?
Yeah.
Fucking as we said goodbye, lightning lightning struck outside my house like we're fucking evil. I can't even believe that. We said goodbye and thunder struck. Like we're fucking evil villains. Goodbye. Okay. That's crazy. All right. I don't know if that picked up on the mic, but that did happen.
Yeah, I'm going to see if I can edit that into the something.
I can't believe that. Okay, anyways, this is not a drill. We'll be back in 2 weeks, guys. Thanks so much for joining us. See you. Bye-bye.